Bruce Laverty has been the senior curator here at the Athenaeum for over 3 decades, and in the course of that time has curated over 100 exhibits, all of them of high quality, and none of them more interesting than the one that's on display right now, which by now I think everybody has had a chance to see, and if by any chance you haven't, then during the lunch period this afternoon, please make sure you do so. He is also one of the go-to guys in the city of Philadelphia for journalists and scholars and architects on all matters architectural. It's a pleasure to introduce my colleague, Bruce Laverty.
Thank you, Peter. About 7 or 8 months ago, when Peter first gathered the staff together and hashed around this idea that there would be a symposium about railroads and what shape that might take, he turned to me and my colleagues and he said, do we have anything on railroads enough to do an exhibit on? And I said, I think we can do it, and I hope you'll agree that we achieved that we had enough to fill the gallery on railroads, and then some. So thank you, Peter, for giving us an opportunity to show off our railroad collection. I'd also like to thank my colleagues in the department who helped put together the exhibit, Jim Carroll, who did all the imaging for the show, Denise Fox, who does the framing and the mounting, and Michael Seneca, who will be with us this afternoon, but did all of the graphic design, not only in the exhibition, but in your handouts and on the website as well. Mike started out his career here as my right arm. He's now at least 1.5 of my legs as well. So a great colleague. I also wanted to thank Chuck Denlinger, a person who is not here today, but Chuck Denlinger is the person who made that fantastic model of the Broad Street Station that is the centerpiece of our exhibition in the gallery, and who was willing to loan it to us. In fact, I left a message on his phone earlier this year. He called me back within 3 minutes and said, how soon do you want to get it? So he was very, very generous with that. I invited him to be our guest at the symposium this weekend, but he had to decline. He and some friends are doing some work in Maine this weekend. They're repairing a narrow gauge railway in Wiscasset, Maine. So he is with us in thought, if not in person. But thank you, Chuck. To my colleagues in the print room at the Library Company who helped me by letting me raid their collection, particularly for this presentation, and to Dr. Roger Moss, who in his leadership here at the Athenaeum for 40 years really assembled an internationally significant collection of architectural materials. So it makes my job as a curator much simpler when someone says, do we have anything on that? So if you haven't had a chance to see the exhibition, it will be open for another 2 weeks. So please tell your friends and family. Now, it's Saturday morning, and you might have had your coffee. There may still be some cobwebs. So I'm going to make you work a little bit this morning. We're going to have a participatory exercise. And so I want everybody to stand up. Everybody stand up. So the topic of my talk is the impact of the railroad on urban design in downtown Philadelphia. And so we're not talking only about the impact of the railroad on the city, but I'd like through this exercise to look and see what the impact is on you as individuals and as a group. Okay, so follow my instructions. If you ever took a train from the B&O terminal on Chestnut Street, sit down. Anybody here ever took a train from the B&O terminal on Chestnut Street, sit down. Anybody sitting?
Yeah, one here.
One, okay, all right. Next, if you ever took a train from the Broad Street Station, sit down. Okay. Three, if you ever took a train to or from Reading Terminal, sit down. Okay. Number four, if you ever dodged a locomotive while driving a car on Delaware Avenue, sit down. Okay. Number five, If you know the significance of the phrase, old maids never wed and have babies, sit down. Okay, and now I'm going to have to ask one of you to prove it. What does that mean? Old maids never wed and have babies. Very good. Okay. And of course, for those, well, we won't go there. Oh, those are the names of the state. It's a mnemonic for remembering the names of the stations on the main line: Overbrook, Marion, Narberth, Ardmore, Haverford, Bryn Mawr. So Wynwood. Yes, I forgot Wynwood. So okay. Now the next set of questions applies not just not for your entire life, but just for the last 30 days. Just for the last 30 days. So not for your whole life, but just the last 30 days. If you have driven on Montgomery Avenue in Lower Merion in the last 30 days, sit down. Okay. If you have spent time in Dilworth Park, sit down. Okay. If you have shopped in the Reading Terminal Market, sit down. If you drove or walked the Benjamin Franklin Parkway, sit down. If you could... Okay. If you could find a legal curbside parking space in Center City, sit down. I had a feeling nobody would sit down for that one. If you traveled on Amtrak in the last 30 days, sit down. If you live in zip code 19103, sit down. Okay. If you have traveled on SEPTA Regional Rail, sit down in the last 30 days. Okay, if you're sitting down, you're already aware of some of the ways that your life in Philadelphia has been affected by railroads, both past and present. I trust that you'll learn a few more ways before my hour is up. If you're still standing, please sit down. We're ready to start the presentation. So here we have... Not a piece of art from the Barnes Foundation, which I understand has more Renoirs than you can shake a stick at. But as I was putting together this presentation, I am a mapophile, and so I had to lay out the railroad lines across the map of Philadelphia, and as you can imagine, it got fairly complicated fairly soon. And so what I did was, I thought, well, let's start out by removing Philadelphia and looking at only the railroads. And what we have between 1832 and the year 1900, so we have 22 separate rail lines that were actually run by about 18 separate companies over that time period. You'll be happy to know that I'm not going to talk about every, well, maybe some of you won't be happy, but I'm not going to talk about every one of those lines or every piece of that system. But I wanted to show this to give you an idea of the complexity of rail life in Philadelphia. Now, one of the things that's very easy for us to forget, since we tend to think of Philadelphia as a railroad town and as an industrial city, is that nearly half of our history took place without a single iron rail on the ground. The city founded in 1683, and it wouldn't be till 1832 that the first railway is operational. So there was a time in Philadelphia when there were no rails. And in fact, a century and a half. And the city developed and got by because its founder, William Penn, gave it this wonderful armature upon which to build. This is Thomas Holmes' 1683 map. It was a real estate. Promotional publication for William Penn to send to send to Europe, particularly England, Ireland, Holland, and Germany, so that he could market his land. It very rational, 2 miles wide by 1 mile high, with the center at Center Square and the four squares in the quadrants around it. As I said, it gave the city an armature on which to build itself. Now, Penn's idea was that the city would grow equally from river to river towards the middle, but it was always Penn's intention that the center square would be the center of urban life in Philadelphia. This is one of my favorite maps, and I'm going to walk around a little bit here so it's easier for me to see what we're looking at here. This is the John Hills map from 1796. Philadelphia was the capital of the nation at that time. One of the reasons I love this map so much is that it's, let's see, it's the first map that actually shows building footprints and development. So you can see here by 1796 we have the Delaware River on the right-hand side, and the city is moving in a arrow shape that is centered on Market Street. And you can see the development here. It laps over the northern boundary at Vine Street into Northern Liberties and into the south in Southwark here. This is also a time when there were only two means of transportation, and that was by, three if you include just walking, but it was horse-drawn transportation or water. And water was seen to be the most efficient means of transportation, both the coastwise trade through the Delaware River, and then beginning earlier in the 18th century, there actually had been canals that were built along the Schuylkill River leading into the northwestern regions. And it was always the dream to build a canal directly across the city of Philadelphia to avoid all of the twists and turns of the lower Schuylkill, to be able to bring canal boats from the Schuylkill to the Delaware River, and geography was in our favor on that. And you actually see on this map a canal had start to be dug around here in the northwest side of the Schuylkill, came down. It was stopped there, but then they were going to take advantage of what was Peg's Run. The other great thing about this map is it shows the topography and it shows the elevations. So this is Peg's Run, which was a creek that was there. They were going to take advantage of that and have a clear shot to the Delaware River. So this is a close-up of that where you can see it a little bit closer. And if you look closer still, you can see here is the Fairmount, which is right against the Schuylkill River, where the Philadelphia Museum of Art is now and where the waterworks would be. The canal comes down along here. Here is Callow Hill Street. Vine Street, the northern boundary of the city, is at the bottom. This diagonal street at the top is what is now Fairmount Avenue. So all of those streets are still in place. So you had the Fairmount over here, and you had some of the country estates, which the Northern Liberties was home to, Springettsbury's Manor there, and then the Bush Hill estate, which actually a year after this map was made would serve as a hospital for the yellow fever epidemic victims. And so remember this spot because we're going to come back to it, and it's fairly important in our talk today. So here we have the Philadelphia's first introduction to a steam engine. The Center Square Waterworks, designed by Benjamin Henry Latrobe, put into operation in the year 1800, pumped water from the Schuylkill River to the Center Square, where it was kept in a reservoir here, and then there was a wood-fired steam engine. You can see the smoke coming out there, that pumped the water to the houses in the rest of the city. Dr. Lick last night showed a slide of a book that was entitled The Machine in the Garden. This was Philadelphia's first machine in the garden, and it was a very much talked about. It was a tourist site both for visitors as well as Philadelphians. And so it was a peaceful place, although not particularly efficient. Steam engines had a tendency to break down quite a bit in those very early days, and finding people who knew how to fix them was difficult. And getting water out of the tap became so popular that there was never more than 20 minutes reserve of water. 20 minutes reserve of water in that tank at any given time. So that if the engine stopped, there was trouble. So this was a stationary steam engine, and Philadelphians fairly quickly became familiar with it. But then there was this, which I've labeled Philadelphia's first duck boat. Anybody know what this is? Nope. Close, though. I'm sorry? Oliver Evans. Oliver Evans was the inventor, and what was this called? It was called the Oructor Amphibilis, which... which is a fancy Latin word for amphibious digger. Oliver Evans was an inventor, and he had gotten a contract to remove sandbars from the Delaware River. And he figured he'd try to find a way to automate that, and so he put a steam engine into a flat-bottom scow, then put it on wheels, and he had the operation set up so that you could there would be buckets that would pull the sand out and then lift them up. He made his first attempt at this, put it on wheels. Some would say this was the first automobile in America because it was self-propelled. Well, he didn't count in the weight of the steam engine, and the wheels collapsed on the very first run. But he went back to the drawing board, made sturdier wheels, and demonstrated this in 1805 on Market Street. He rode this thing up Market Street, drove it around the center square pumping station, so you had a mobile steam engine and you had a stationary steam engine at once, headed west on Market Street, and then, just like the duck boats, went into the Schuylkill River, sailed down the Schuylkill River around South Philadelphia, and then came back out of the water at Delaware Avenue and Dock Street. So it really created quite a splash, literally. But Evans was way, way ahead of his time. And he didn't make any money off of that, and he got involved in some other things. So this map is made at a time when Philadelphia is on top of the world, or at least on top of the United States. But beginning in the 1790s, we start to topple from the top. I teach history of Philadelphia architecture at Drexel University, and What I do in this particular phase in the class is I refer to how Philadelphia fell from the top in this 35-year period. So in 1793, there's the yellow fever epidemic, which devastates the population in Philadelphia. 1799, the capital moves to Harrisburg. 1800, the U.S. capital moves to D.C. In 1810, the top population spot in the country moves to New York City. And then in 1825, the Erie Canal is opened. And then the final nail in the coffin was that we lost the financial center of the country to New York City forever in 1837 with the panic that destroyed the Bank of the United States. Part of that, and probably the most important part of that, was what was called Clinton's Ditch, the Erie Canal. This was a 10-year public works project across the state of New York, and the geography gods of New York had blessed the state in that while it was difficult to build the canal, they didn't have to cross the Allegheny Ridge. And they took advantage of the Mohawk River Valley to connect Buffalo, and even more importantly, Lake Erie and the West, to the Hudson River and to New York City. As this canal came to be, as it became obvious that it was going to be a reality and that it was going to be completed, Philadelphia movers and shakers got more and more concerned, panicked, if you will. And in a great sort of Franklinian method, they identified a problem, created a committee to investigate it, and came up with the potential solutions. And so they created the Pennsylvania Society for the Promotion of Internal Improvements. And so we had to find out how in Pennsylvania, and in Philadelphia in particular, we could compete with New York and figure out how to, today we would call it infrastructure, in those days they called it internal improvements, but how to improve transportation and trade within the state of Pennsylvania. And so they hired a bright young architect by the name of William Strickland, who was the first architect to be a member of the Athenaeum as of 1820. And what did they do? They sent him to England, where the Industrial Revolution was in full swing, to steal, I mean, glean ideas from the Brits about all sorts of things, canals, railways, roads, tunnels, piers, docks, and highways. And so of all of those things that they sent him to report on, he was there for 6 months. He wrote a 40-page textual report. Of those 40 pages, 10 pages, one quarter, was devoted to railways. They were expecting him to come back telling them how to build efficient canals. And essentially, Strickland comes back and says, well, the canals are good, but, you know, the railway is the future. He was so enthusiastic about the railways that many of the members of the Society for Promotion of Internal Improvements, who had already invested heavily in canals, said, hey, Bill, let's calm down a little bit about the railways. You know, let's tamp that down a little bit. And so, oh, by the way, in the exhibition downstairs, we have his report, which is beautifully illustrated. And you'll notice that the Athenaeum of Philadelphia was the first listed subscriber. And also, down at the bottom there, the House of Representatives of the United States bought 25 copies. A couple of interesting others that I didn't notice until this morning. DeWitt Clinton was a subscriber to this, so I guess he was trying to see what the competition was doing. And I heard you say, Dane, yeah, there's Baldwin's name. And so a lot of the movers and shakers were reading this report, and it's impossible to overstate the importance of this report in the development of railroads, not just in Pennsylvania, but nationwide. And of course, he illustrated it with these beautiful, this is his centerfold, if you will, in this report, showing a detailed drawing of Stevenson's locomotive engine. What was new here, where they had improved above Oliver Evans, is that it was a steam engine on iron wheels on iron rails. Since steam engines were so temperamental and roads were so bad, you needed to provide a smooth operation for them. So, beginning in 1832, beginning in 1826, based on the report that William Strickland had done, the Pennsylvania began what was called the Pennsylvania System for Public Works, which was a hybrid system through statewide that connected railways, some new railways, canals, incline planes, portages, and highways. And in this next section, I call this Philadelphia Embraces the Railroad, but at arm's length. And so we come back to this area just north of Vine Street from this 1796 map, and I call this Philadelphia's first industrial park. The city councils of Philadelphia thought railroads were a fine idea and thought they would be terrific in terms of the business that they would bring to Philadelphia and to the state. But the idea of locomotive engines, steam engines, driving down the streets of the city of Philadelphia, frankly scared them, and it scared a lot of the population as well, primarily for three reasons. One is the potential for collision. The second was the noise and the dirt that they dispensed, but then also the potential chance of fire, because those steam engines spewed out cinders out of their smokestacks. And so the city councils in 1832 prohibited locomotive engines from going on the streets of Philadelphia. Again, it's a pivotal thing to the way the city developed. And so what that meant was that if you were going to have a railroad station where locomotives went, it had to be outside the city. And so the first ones were in the northern area, and they took advantage of the canal that had already been laid out and surveyed. And so here we have the beginning of the Philadelphia and Columbia Railroad. It's the red line, the dark red line there, which starts at the corner of Broad and Vine Streets. Made its way along the route of the canal, past the Fairmount, skirted on what is now Pennsylvania Avenue, through the park, across a bridge, and there's a wonderful drawing from the Franklin Institute that shows the route of the railroad. And then across the bridge, it's called the Columbia Bridge. A lot of Philadelphians think it's Columbia Avenue. It's Columbia, Pennsylvania, because that's where the railroad was heading. And you've got some scullers there in the foreground. And so it continued on there to Columbia, Pennsylvania. Now, this is a profile map of the system, starting in Philadelphia on the right-hand side here, and going in Pittsburgh. You can see the problem here out at the Allegheny Ridge, out between Johnstown and Altoona. But here in Philadelphia, notice if you look closely here, there's this huge this huge jump from relatively flat land, and then it makes its way. The railroad made its way up to Paoli, Downingtown, Coatesville, Lancaster, until they went to the Columbia on the Susquehanna Railroad, where it connected with canals. This portion between Philadelphia and Columbia, Pennsylvania, was called the main line of the Pennsylvania Public Works. And so from Philadelphia to Columbia was called the main line. What we think of as the main line today is the same part, but a much smaller and more defined section. But the term main line comes from that. So that big hike here is illustrated here. The first mountain that they met was just on the west side of the Schuylkill. It was the Belmont Hill. And so locomotives could not get up that hill. And so they had an inclined plane, which was operated by steam. And it must have been like going up in a roller coaster. You know, I can just hear the engines going chuck, 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 chuck. And it got to the top of the road at about where the Peters Mansion is, Belmont Mansion in Fairmount Park. And then continued on through Lower Murray and partially along the route of Montgomery Avenue. So if you drove, that's why I asked the question about Montgomery Avenue. It was originally out that way. So the railroad started at Broad and Vine Street, but how would people get to the rest of town? Well, they could take carriages, but in 1833, the city built the Philadelphia City Railway, which was railway lines on Broad and Market Street that connected with the satellite terminals. So what would happen at Broad and Vine or the other satellite terminals is that locomotives would be disconnected, horses would be hooked up, and then the horses would draw either the freight cars or the passenger cars up and down Market Street so that people could get to where they had to go. And so one of the places they went was the Merchants Exchange. This view by Frank Taylor shows that they actually had rail cars that had the canal boats on them. So you could go to the Merchants Exchange and you could get on a canal boat that was on rails. That way, when you got to the Susquehanna, you didn't have to switch out. You didn't have to leave the boat. Now, it was a very efficient system. If you left the Merchants Exchange at 8 o'clock in the morning and you were headed for Pittsburgh, you would arrive in Pittsburgh by 4 o'clock on the fourth day. And that was only if it wasn't wintertime or mud season, as they call it in New England. So the area in that first industrial part became a natural place for people like Matthias Baldwin, another Athenaeum member, to set up their works. He created the first locomotive in the United States. And this is a sketch of the Baldwin Locomotive Works that was done in his own hands. He chose the site of Broad and Hamilton because it was just at the foot of the brand new Philadelphia and Columbia Railroad. And if you're going to build railroad cars, you want to have them close to where the railroad tracks are. And so by the end of the 19th century, Baldwin Locomotive Works was the largest single employer in Philadelphia, with 18,000 employees and factory buildings that extended from Spring Garden Street on the right to the Philadelphia and Columbia Railroad on the left there, all the way back to about 20th Street. So this was heavy, heavy industry. Another factor of where those railroads ended up, because locomotives couldn't come into Center City, it kept heavy, heavy industry out of the downtown area. And that affected the way the city developed in big, big ways. And ultimately, it affected how we have the city today. Along Willow Street, which was the connection from Hamilton Street to the river, we have other foundries as well. Again, heavy industry here. This is the Crescent Foundry from the Crescent Iron Works. And here, the Neal and Matthews Bush Hill Ironworks. Okay, and this was run actually by this the Sellers Company. And this is a view from about 1853. Here you can see some of those boilers being made right there. There were satellite industries that made parts and made pieces of the engines that were being used in the Baldwin locomotive. So it was a very well-run complex of multiple industries that served the creation of the railroad in that northern area there. So the next railroad that I want to talk about, and I'm not going to talk about them all, is the Philadelphia, Germantown, and Norristown. Again, they couldn't build their depot in the city of Philadelphia, so it's built at the corner of 9th and Green Street, and Baldwin built the locomotive, and again, you have those cars that were shaped like gondolas. Hopefully, you didn't have to go into any water between Philadelphia and Germantown. Took 45 minutes to get to Germantown. It took 30 minutes to get back because it was downhill. Here's where they ended up, at Germantown and Price Street. They called it the Main Street Depot. This was actually designed by Joseph Hoxie in 1855. So let's talk a little bit about people who traveled on the railroad. And I was fortunate enough to be able to find diary entries from a number of significant folks and maybe not so well known. And one of our favorite sons here at the Athenaeum is Thomas Eustach Walter, the architect of Girard College, which was under construction at the time. He was the premier architect of the city, had outshone his mentor, William Strickland, by that time. So in 1835, in his own diary, Walter records a trip that he makes to New York. And he says, left Philadelphia by railroad at 8 o'clock a.m., conveyed by locomotive engine, 10 miles an hour to Trenton. And I think I've been on some SEPTA trains that did that. From Trenton to Newark by uncomfortable stage coaches. And from Newark to Jersey City on another railroad. The rails are laid on wood. Okay? And he said, I am fearful that the railroad mania will be the means of introducing so many bad roads that the whole system will be abandoned. I believe that no extensive railroads will be in use 20 years hence. Canals are better! Exclamation point, exclamation point. He was a brilliant architect, but not so much a prophet. He made it to Jersey City, where he overnighted, because in his diary he talks about how he went to he crossed over to New York the next day on the ferry. He was in New York for about a week, and on the way home from New York, he's taking the Camden and Amboy Railroad, on the return trip on January 19th, he left New York at 7 p.m. He overnighted in Jersey City. And he arrived in Philadelphia the next day at 1:30, so the trip was a little better. And along the way, he mentioned seeing Mr. Biddle's country seat, which is Andalusia, which was the property that he was designing at that time. He sees it from the railway across the river, and he said it was about 6 miles below Burlington. So there's actually railroads on both sides of the river by that time, and we have Mr. Walter's. Estimate of same. If you see this man's picture, Sidney George Fisher, if you saw his picture in the Encyclopedia of 19th Century, next to the word snob, next to the word whiner, next to the word freeloader, curmudgeon, but a very, very keen observer of everything Philadelphian in the 19th century. And so I had to go to Sidney George Fisher's diary and see what he had to say about railroad travel. He goes to Dickinson College, where he had attended, which is in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And so he's looking at this in 1838, so this is 3 years after Walter makes his trip. Left town at 6 o'clock, got here at 5 the same afternoon. 120 miles, it seems like magic. And when I used to come to college here 10 years ago, we started at 3 in the morning in coaches and arrived at Harrisburg after a toilsome journey of 100 miles at 12 that night. So it went from 3 in the morning to 12 at night just to get to Harrisburg. The weather was warm, but there was a fine breeze, which, however, we could not enjoy because the sparks from the locomotive flew thick and we were obliged to shut the windows. So he presents an issue there. So I want to talk a little bit about the downtown depots. These were depots that were created not to serve locomotives, but to serve the cars that were drawn by horses. And one of them was designed by Thomas Eustace Walter. This drawing is downstairs for the Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Wilmington Railroad. And here's a wonderful David Kennedy view from the Library Company from 1852 that shows the southeast corner of 11th and Market Street, the Mansion House Hotel there, and then you have the railroad station, you know, this wonderful sort of quasi-Greek Georgian Revival building that just happened to have these train cars going into it. And the actual procedure of moving cars in and out can be seen a little closer up if we look at a detail there. So we see here the number of animals that it took to pull one of those strings of cars. I counted at least eight. I don't know whether they're mules or horses, but there's a lot of animal flesh just for the transfer of one car. We have another diary entry that we found. It was written by a woman whose name was Charlotte Stein. And she came to Philadelphia in 1856 to visit her her two twin sons, Nathan and Aaron. They were 18 years old. And I'm not sure whether it was her first trip on a train, but it was her first trip to a big city. And so she describes what she saw. And she said, in the cars, she's taking the train from Reading to Philadelphia. In the cars, I made a speaking acquaintance with a lady from Philadelphia who, no doubt, taking a hint from sundry questions of mine, kindly volunteered to point out the towns and other places of note along the road. Of course, these I remember Phoenixville, Pottstown, and my first glimpse of Fairmount. She came down along the Pennsylvania Avenue route there, the cars passing within 200 yards of the latter place. I may never see this lady again, but feel that the only return I can make for her kindness is to record it here in my journal. She says, a short distance from the depot in Philadelphia, and that's the depot that she came to at Broad and Callow Hill Street, a short distance from the depot in Philadelphia, the locomotive detached and the cars are drawn by horses. Here, a great many people took to the street, and under the impression that our journey was over, I followed example. The first person I encountered there was Nathan, her son, and my rising fears were instantly dispelled. Aaron joined me in an instant, and to take share in the handshaking that ensued, he having made his way through the cars in search of me. So, One of the twins is outside the car waiting for Mom. Mom has gotten off the train mistakenly. The other twin is going inside the train to look for Mom to make sure that they don't miss her. A walk of about a square to the carriage in waiting served to tune my limbs again. And with one boy beside me and one in front, we were rattling along the stone pavement of the streets of the Quaker City. And then she's got a wonderful diary where she explains all the wonderful things in Philadelphia that her two sons showed to her for the next 2 weeks. So, in 1856, that same year, three years later, we go back to Sidney George Fisher, the near miss. He went with George Smith and Henry, that was his brother, in the 2:30 train to dine at Brookwood. This is the 2:30 train on the North Penn Railroad. When near Fisher's Lane station, we had a collision with some cars laden with stone going around a curve. There was a great crash and much alarm. Luckily, no one was hurt, and we had a most narrow escape. As had we been thrown from the track, the whole train would have gone down a bank 50 feet. One baggage car did go down. He walked on to Green Lane, where I met Henry's wagon. So Green Lane would have been about a mile walk from the station that had that. So he talks about a train wreck that he's in. His nephew had been killed in a train accident in Bordentown with 30 other people the year before in 1855. And this brings up the issue of the danger of railroads. As early as 1836, the Public Ledger was talking about the dangers involved in railroads, but the advantages as well. And in one article they said, the new marvel, the railroad, are its cars whizzing along like comets. it would make Philadelphia a bustling metropolis. And then there's an interesting calculus that's made. Of course there would be problems. Probably horses would be knocked down, a cow cut in halves, a score of pigs quartered, a dozen dogs mangled. The ledger was even prepared to accept the accidental death of children, perhaps a dozen or so annually, but this is a trifle. And lest we think that the callous reporters at the public ledger, unless we shake our heads at them, it's good for us to remember. I want to get the quote proper here. Here we have it. that in 2015, there were over 150,000 Americans who were killed by automobiles, and 613 were children. And so it's easy to look at our 19th century forebears and say, how could they have been so callous and to think that a dozen or so kids who get killed a year is a trifle. Somebody who didn't think that it was a trifle was this woman, who is obviously in distress because those kids being carted off are two dead children and one that's severely burned. And so she didn't think it was a trifle. This was the dreadful accident on the North Penn Railroad, about 5 miles above where Sidney Fisher had his accident, and just about 2 months later. This occurred in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania, on a single-track railroad where two locomotives hit head-on. The locomotive coming south only had 20 people on it. The locomotive going north was an excursion train for a Sunday school picnic from the St. Michael's Church. 1,500 people on that train, including lots and lots of children. There were at least 60 people killed, and of those 60, at least 50 were under the age of 18. When the trains collided, both steam boilers exploded and derailed the rest of the train. But what happened was it flipped the cars over and fire caught very, very rapidly in the wooden cars. And most of the people who died were not killed with the accident, but were burned to death. And the parents and the folks from the countryside were trying to save people who were trapped, but they couldn't get close enough to the heat. This was the first major disaster associated with machines in America, and it was the worst railroad disaster in the world up to that point. This particular lithograph was done shortly after the time. If you look at the bottom there, it was drawn by somebody who was on the site. And by the way, it happened very early in the morning, 6 a.m. Lithographed from a drawing taken upon the spot and for sale at 68 Passyunk Road. So you could buy this, I guess, as a memorial. It seems a little maudlin to us. So the risks were real. And certainly after 1856, it was. Here we have the Port Richmond Railway, which this is the bridge that goes over the Schuylkill River near East Falls. And I just wanted to show you, step off of the PowerPoint for a moment here to show you some of the amazing things that that our Philadelphia Architects and Buildings and Geohistory projects can show. Here we have, it's a bird's eye view. Oops. Ah, fooled you.
I didn't know you were doing this.
Yep, sorry. Here we have a bird's eye view that looks towards the Delaware River from 1864 in the Port Richmond section of Philadelphia. And sometimes trains, railroad tracks quite often made it onto maps, but occasionally railroad trains actually even made it, the trains themselves made it onto the maps. And so if we look closely here we have a train. It's the Philadelphia, Trenton, and New York Railroad going right up Trenton Avenue there. But then if we scroll over to Lehigh Avenue, we see this very, very long train of empty coal cars. And where is it coming from? Those empty cars, which continue for block after block after block. We're going to the Philadelphia and Reading coal wars here. And so, over. Sorry. Go ahead. Keep going. Okay. And this is a view of the Reading coal yards in the early 1970s, and the reason I like this is because it shows Interstate 95 just as it was newly opened at that time. I was told by someone last night that two-thirds of the operation is still working there at the Richmond Yards, one of the biggest coal transfer stations in America. Let's speed things along. This is the Philadelphia, Wilmington, and Baltimore Railroad station at Broad and Washington. You can see City Hall in the background. And there are all of the horse cars that are waiting to take people to various parts of the city. And here is the freight station, which was right next door to it. Good news, the passenger terminal is gone, but the freight station remains. It has been historically certified, and it is currently undergoing renovation, even as we speak. And so it's a success story there. Let's skip over that. Opposite the station was the Citizens Volunteer Hospital, which was used as a Civil War hospital during the Civil War. This is a view of the Reading Depot of Broad Street just above Filbert. This is where the Masonic Temple is now. And here's a view of Market Street at 12. And this is from about 1856. This is the Farmer's Market, which would eventually become the Reading Terminal here. Notice there is a boxcar right in the middle of Market Street there. This is a Robert Newell photograph. This is the Willow Street Railroad at front and Willow Street, and see, even on very narrow streets, you had train cars, both larger box cars and then the horse-drawn cars there. This is where the Willow Street Railway ended and the North Penn Railroad began, and the Reading Terminal, the Reading Lines had their wharves right across the street from that. For those of you who were dodging cars on Delaware Avenue, this is the sort of thing that you would have seen. Here's a view of City Hall under construction. The rail lines were already there. And so it made it easier to bring the marble and bring the brickwork and construction material right into the middle of the courtyard. In this view, the building on the left here, this large flat building, that was the Pennsylvania Railroad Freight Depot. It was between Juniper and 13th Street on Market. It was purchased by a man named John Wanamaker in 1875 when the city railway was shut down. And of course, it became home to the Moody Sankey revival meetings and then of course the world's first real department store. So there's a period between 1876 and 1892 that I call Railroad Triumphant, where we have the consolidation of railroads and the creation of the big three stations in Philadelphia. The Broad Street Station, first built by the Wilson brothers. This is a comparison of the Broad Street Station with St. Pancras Station in London. The first time I went to London, I stumbled upon St. Pancras, and I thought, oh my gosh, I've just seen Broad Street Station. This is what it must have been like. It was interesting to sort of compare these two, particularly since there are so few images of the Broad Street Station in color. And of course, this is the Chinese Wall. One of the deals that the Pennsylvania Railroad made it to allow locomotives to come into the city was that they had to be elevated above street level. And so while it was safer for the pedestrians, it was tougher on urban developers. That's 15th Street, the foot of Market Street, as electricity entered the picture. Here is a view of that industrial park. And this is Broad Street, Spring Garden, the Baldwin Locomotive Works here. And then this is Town Hill Street. This is what it appeared in 1895. And so the city decided that having that many tracks crossing Broad Street at grade was extremely dangerous. I counted 15 tracks there, and you see all those horses and carriages and pedestrians having to work their way through one of the busiest rail yards in the city. And so they proposed depressing the tracks there, creating what was called the Pennsylvania Avenue Tunnel, which serves today as a potential park, went out west along and skirted along the parkway and through a tunnel into the park. And of course, it was during this time that the parkway itself is created from the 1890s through the 1920s, which sort of drives a wedge and demolishes 800 buildings in this area in the northwest quadrant of Philadelphia. There's this wonderful cautionary tale called North of Market Street that put into novel format the division that the Chinese Wall created and the greater psychological division behind it. It's the story of a young woman from New York who comes to Philadelphia to study at the Women's Medical College. Her name is Helen, she's a fictional character, Helen Van Rensselaer, and some of her friends in New York say, by the way, where is your boarding house? Is it north or south of Market Street? I don't know, answered Helen, it's on Grafton Street, about a mile from Girard College, which is not too far from where the women's college was. Oh dear, said he in a distressed tone, that is all wrong. It should be at least 2 miles, or 2 miles and a fraction at least, south, if my memory serves. An inch more or less makes all the difference in the world in your social position in Philadelphia. The downtown people despise the uptown people because they don't live downtown, and the uptown people despise each other because the downtown people despise them. And the dividing line was Market Street and Broad Street Station and the Chinese Wall emphasized that. If you have a chance to read that, we have it here in our collection. It's a wonderful read about how the social doors of mannered society slammed shut as soon as they found out your address had a North in it, even if your name was Widener or Elkins, or perhaps especially. Here you see a comparison map of the areas from 1895 on the left, 1910 on the right. And so part of the decision to build the parkway not only demolished many, many houses, but it sort of was the first step in the deindustrialization of that industrial park. And the writing was on the wall, and by the 1930s, all of those factories were gone. And of course, in 1923, there was a fire that destroyed the terminal at Broad Street Station, not the terminal, but the shed. Pennsylvania Railroad never decided that they weren't going to rebuild it. By the way, this fire, as you can see, which was quite massive, within 18 hours of the fire being extinguished, the Pennsylvania Railroad had the service going again in and out of that station. 500 trains a day, both intercity as well as commuter trains. And you can see people shuttling past the rubble there. But the railroad decided not to rebuild the shed, and they came up with what were called the Philadelphia improvements. One was to get rid of the Chinese Wall. This is the south side. This is the north side on Filbert Street. And to separate the intercity travel from the commuter travel. So this is Pennsylvania Suburban Station. And 30th Street Station, west of Schuylkill. This is a 1931 view of what the city would look like in 1941. And all of these were Pennsylvania Railroad projects. And the idea was once you tore down the station, you could build properties here and make up in real estate what you were losing on the railroad. The only two of these things in this image that were built were Suburban Station and 30th Street, circled there. You know these fellows who would build it after World War II, demolishing it all. This is the view from 30th Street, and Penn Center goes up in the mid-1950s. And the last part has to do with building over the tracks, particularly west of the Schuylkill. This is a study by Vincent Kling from the early 1960s for building a new ballpark for Philadelphia. It's something right out of the Jetsons. But it took another 30 years, but things would be built over the tracks there and continue to be. The ultimate connection would be made in that tiniest of red dots there. And people don't see it, but like sewer pipes under your house, they're very important, and you don't notice them until they're not there. Between 1977 and 1983, the commuter tunnel was dug, which connected the Pennsylvania lines and the Reading lines and created a unified passenger railroad system in Philadelphia. And one of the great success stories of Philadelphia is that we didn't tear down Reading Terminal when that was completed. It's a great success story in the reuse and the restoration of that building and the reuse of the train shed as part of the convention center. But railroad buildings were not as grand. This is the entrance to the Market East Station. And ironically, it was tied in with the Gallery Mall, which is now being rebuilt 40 years later. Not too many views into the station. This is a view from 11th Street looking down. I love those tile walls. Still can't figure out what that's supposed to be. But that's nice, but very difficult to access from the street. An irony here is that Broad Street Chinese Wall, which was seen as so great to eliminate, was replaced on the east side of Broad Street by these parking garages. So at 11th Street, I took these photographs last week, 11th and Market, 10th and Market, 9th and Market, 8th and Market, all have parking garages that are built over the street. So there's still a tunnel, not quite as tough as the other one. So where are we in untangling this mess? What are some of the lessons learned? One is that where the railroads went, where in particular the locomotives went, made a huge impact on the city. In North Philadelphia, where the railroads went, the industry went. And when the industry left, North Philadelphia suffered. If you compare the infrastructure that survives in South Philadelphia with North Philadelphia in terms of housing, you notice that South Philadelphia, which was served only on the perimeter by the Beltline Railroad, has not suffered in the same way that North Philadelphia did. And it's because there weren't lots and lots of heavy factories except along Washington Avenue in South Philadelphia. The other thing is that it sort of completely changed the character of the entire northwest quadrant of the city, first making it an industrial area, then making it a cultural center. And it protected the southwest quadrant, 19103, as a primary residential area that never had to worry about industry in any of its phases. And we have a great system which is built on that 19th century system. So ultimately, here we have the tracks at 30th and Market Street, and the buildings that are going up there today. I have a good friend who just moved here from Shanghai 2 years ago, and I said, he's lived in Shanghai, Sydney, London, and San Francisco. I said, why did you choose Philadelphia? He said, it's so green, there's so much space here, and it's so easy to get around on mass transportation. And I thought, okay. And he has since bought 3 properties, including his own house, since he's here, and he wants to look for more. So I think that's wonderful. So we've gone in 185 years from canal boats on Dock Street to Shanghai on the Schuylkill. Thank you very much.